Do last time is we didn't talk a lot about the years. I've been trying to kind of give a timeline as we've gone along. You know, we talked about the Exodus taking roughly 81 years, and again, these are approximations. They wandered in the wilderness 40 years, we know that. The invasion of the land, when we got into Joshua, that was about 50 years, give or take. And then this time frame that we're in now, the judges, is roughly around 300 years, give or take. And there's some pretty distinct times that we can read through each judge. It might tell how long the land rested or how long they judged their people. And so it's fairly easy to get close, but there are some gaps, just like anything else. So I wanted to go back through that quickly. We left off last time, if you'll just turn to the book of Judges. I had given a fairly high-level overview of the book, and we talked about a few things that we were going to get into. We talked about these cycles with the children that they were going to go through. We talked about some of these cycles that we're going to see with the judges, how one judge would come about, things would be great, or maybe great, and then as that leader died, they would go right back to what they were doing. We talked a little bit about there in verse 10 of chapter 2 about the children being ignorant. We talked about that doesn't mean that they literally just didn't know God, but they literally just didn't acknowledge Him. They turned their back on Him. And so anyway, we know that the children of Israel at this time had done evil in the sight of the Lord. And that brought us basically, we were in chapter 2. I'm going to backtrack here. We were in chapter 2, and we had just gotten to the point where we had talked about, I had said, you know, was there ever a name, has a person ever just been maybe so evil that you've been around, or you don't like being around somebody to the degree because they're so bad that when you hear their name, it almost makes you cringe? And, you know, I was thinking about God when He had to think about the her Ashtaroths, what that had to feel like to Him. And all these gods, and I use the gods with a lowercase g, had to feel like to Him, what that must have been like to know that your children who you've delivered this whole time and now turned their back and are worshiping these gods. So, verses 14 and 15, we see the Lord's anger here in response of Israel's sin. And the image of slavery is brought into to play. And I think this is just to tell us how much they had turned from Him. This is how bad it had gotten. It had displeased Him to the point where it says there in 14, "And the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, so He delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them, and He sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, so they could no longer stand before their enemies. Wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for a calamity." Now think about the difference. Just a few short books ago, a few short chapters ago, you know, this is totally opposite. Instead of Him delivering them as He had before and just helping them slaughter others, you know, we now see Him delivering Him into the hands of those that would oppress them and who would, you know, turn them into slaves. And the Lord was against them. And we see that just a complete 180 here. And it says He was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were greatly distressed. We see that statement, the Lord had sworn to them. He had told them that this would happen. And, you know, what two things did Joshua pass along to them as his farewell speech? If you think back to what Joshua said, he said there's going to be blessings and protection for your obedience. If you're obedient, the Lord will deliver you. He will take care of you. You will be blessed. But he also said, one short sentence later, that there will be punishment for disobedience. There will be punishment for idolatry. All these things that you enter in, you're gonna pay for it. Okay. But yeah.
Does this signal the beginning of God's people dabbling with idols? Now, I think maybe there's been some mention before. Is this kind of really the time that they have told the whole group of
Chase? Absolutely, and I think as we get into this, and I've got a verse later, and I can't remember how much later, but we'll get to it. But it talks.
They did worship the golden calf.
But this is where there was a major turn. I think to your point, where significantly, I mean, we're going to get into. They weren't just worshiping a god, But there's one verse, and we'll get to it later in this book, where it mentions every group of people and their gods they were worshiping. And so I think, to your point, this is a significant turn. So yeah, to Ben's point, this isn't the first time they had worshiped idols or worshiped, you know, other gods, but this is where you can see a complete major turn.
Not that they necessarily worshipped in Egypt, but they would have been familiar with them because the Egyptians worshipped
them. Oh, yeah, they knew about it. Yep.
And they would have been around that every day.
Yep. Yep. And there's a difference between living amongst it, seeing it, knowing it, and now doing it. And so I think that's a great point. And, you know, to Mike's point there, you know, that's... Remember, we're doing this so there are lessons to us. But if you're among something, you're around it, you may think, well, I'm not going to partake. That's not a big deal. But we see that just as we're getting ready to get into this, as the as he had said, don't intermarry, don't worship their idols. What do they do? Well, I'm not going to completely drive out the people. It's okay. I mean, you know, they can live amongst us. And so what do they do? They intermarry. They start worshiping their gods. Eddie?
Do we have examples where maybe... generation that obeyed God, did they disobey, or was this a generation later? You know, it seemed like I read somewhere where it was another generation that forgot.
Well, clearly, I mean, the generation that had died off, and that, you know, this is a younger generation because we've read how that generation had to, you know, do certain things. But yeah, this is the generation that now, as they've turned to God and God has led them, is now getting ready to turn their back. I mean, this time frame through Judges, yeah.
I think it's told that the elders that lived when Joshua was alive, they served the Lord, but when they died, then that's when Israel went astray.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, you know, the first judge, Othniel, he's the son of Caleb's younger brother. So you get the picture that, you know, Caleb and his brother are gone, and then the children of Israel, then they fall away, and then they need Othniel to be the judge.
Yeah. Yep. Ben's stealing and thunder here.
Verses 7 through 11 and 12.
Right.
Yeah. What generation was.
Okay, good. Yep. And we know that, you know, in that first verse there in 7 where it talks about they served him all the days of Joshua, we know that. I mean, that's when Joshua died off, you know, just as he was trying to do what Moses had done and hand it down and say, hey, it's okay, he's still going to be on your side. We know that there was a significant change. And let's see here, Mike. Yeah, they had buried him. And then when all the generation had been gathered together, fathers, another, and we're probably going to read that, but had been gathered together, fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord. That's that part we were talking about where we left off. Did they not know him? Literally hadn't heard of him, don't know anything about him? No. They just chose to turn their back on him and not serve him. Okay.
19, that they wouldn't cease from their own doings nor their stubborn way.
Okay. So, yeah, and this is good. I've got down, let's read 16 through 19. So, you guys are just eager to get there. Will somebody read chapter 2, verses 16 through 19?
Nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they would not listen to their judges, but they played the harlot with other gods and bowed down to them. They turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked, and obeying the commandments of the Lord, they did not do so. And when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning, because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. And it came to pass, when the judge was dead, that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers, by following other gods, to serve them and bow down to them. They did not cease from their own doings, nor from their stubborn way.
Okay, good. So that's an important passage that sets all this stuff that we're getting ready to get into. So we're getting ready to get into our first judge, and that basically tells you, you know, these judges were established by the Lord. They were put in place, and there's definitely some cycles, and we're going to talk about that today. And I think that's a lesson for us, is that just as you saw them turn to the Lord, and then quickly, you, as one leader died off, they would turn back just that fast. And so we've got about 12 judges that we'll go into, you know, as extensive as there is. But when you look at Shamgar, Tola, Jer, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon. There's hardly anything said about him, which is kind of interesting. Think about this. Think about a judge ruling over people, and all the Bible can basically do is tell you who they were, maybe something about their donkeys and kids, and then when they died and where they were buried. That's all that could be really mentioned, which is kind of, and I'm sure there's a lot of details there, but that's pretty sad. And then we'll get into some of the major ones, you know, Othniel, Ehud, Gideon, Jephthah, and Samson. There's some great stories, so we'll hit the high points of those. But these four verses are a good basic intro to the book of Judges itself, okay? Verse 18, we have a good indication of God's compassion. How specifically was God compassionate towards the people? Well, he raised up judges for them, okay? So we get the feeling that these judges were raised up for them so that they could help deliver the people and give them relief from their enemies, which was important. And yet, in verse 19, we see another indication of these cycles that it just talks about. Once the judges would die, the people would turn from the Lord and they would go back. They would revert. So what indication here do we have, and it was read, but that things got worse? In verse 19, it says they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bowing down to them. So things were, as we know, waxing old. And what a lesson for us today. Are things waxing old today? Is this world waxing old? Are things getting potentially worse and worse and worse? And is it easier to slide a little bit further? And so I think that verse 10, them not knowing God, it's just getting worse. Okay. Let's see here. Okay. So why did the Lord have the remnant? You know, when we talked about, so the children were going to inhabit the land, and they all had their respected areas to go to, you know, there was a remnant left in each of the lands. Why do you think that remnant was left? And I think Dwayne answered this last week. Does anybody remember? Okay. Yeah, so it was a test for them, and, you know, just as the Lord tests us today, it was a test for them, and we see that they didn't do very well with that. But if we look at, there's probably about three or four things that we could talk about. He chose to punish them as Israel turned from God towards their idols, and we've read a bunch of places, and we're going to read more of those. He is fulfilling the promise that was made to Joshua there at the very, very end in Joshua chapter 23. That promise is fulfilled. If you do X, this will happen. Well, we read, it's happening. Just as Ben said, number two is to test Israel's faithfulness, and we're going to get into that. Chapter 2, verse 22 says, "So that through them I may test Israel, whether they keep the ways of the Lord, to walk in them as their fathers kept them or not." In chapter 3, verse 4, it says, "And they were left that he might test Israel by them." So we have very specific, we can answer that question very specifically. They were left so that there was a testing. Yeah, Eddie.
Talking about the remnant.
Yeah.
If you think back to the captivity when they went to Babylonia, the remnant was like Daniel, you know, some of those men that we regard as faithful to the Lord.
Yeah.
They were in that captivity also.
Yeah.
Yet they were the remnant of the Lord.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yet another thing we might think about is, you know, we got to remember that this younger generation, as Eddie brought up before, this is a different generation. They didn't really have any experience in warfare. You know, if you think about what their fathers went through and how they just mowed people down, this group hasn't experienced that. They hadn't fought battles, and so I think that was another piece of this test is you know, they're going to be fighting, there's going to be some warfare, and are they going to choose God and be on His side and have the same success as their fathers or not? So we might say that. One of the other things that I came across I thought was interesting, well, somebody go to Deuteronomy chapter 7 when we talk about people inhabiting the land, and, you know, this is a point today that even, you know, we know that it's important for mankind to hunt off the animals on the land. Someone read Deuteronomy 7, verses 20 through 24. I think this gives us another reason.
"The Lord your God will send the hornet from also those who are left, who hide themselves from you, are destroyed. You shall not be terrified of them, for the Lord your God, the great and awesome God, is among you. And the Lord your God will drive out those nations before you, little by little. You will be unable to destroy them at once, lest the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. For the Lord your God will deliver you over to them, and will inflict defeat upon them until they are destroyed. He will deliver their kings in your hand, and you will destroy their name from under heaven. No one shall be able to stand against you until you have destroyed them.
Okay, so it's good to back up and see this, but the Lord didn't want them to be overran with not only people, but the beasts or animals of the land. And so I think that's interesting. It gives them time to populate the earth and control the wildlife, the wilderness, and those that were about them. So I think that's a good verse to go back to. We talked about this, the downward steps of Israel, you know, their verses 5 through 6, and we are reminded in very, very plain English there that they were walking away from God. They weren't getting closer, they were walking away. And really, it's just like we talked about where Joshua handed off. Step one was they decided to live amongst the Canaanites and other nations. Okay, they chose to live with them, and they made that decision instead of driving them off. And step two was, what they do? So they live amongst them. They're going to get married to them. So now they intermarry. Step three was, well, now we're married to them, and they have got an interesting God. I mean, it's kind of neat, so I'm going to serve their gods. So pretty simple progression that we can see. And oh, how it seems to start so innocently and simple. Well, we're just going to live with them. We don't need to drive them out. We don't need to kill them. And so this had been described, and in chapter 2, verses 11 through 19, we've read part of those, and so we see that. We understand it. Okay, does anyone have any comments about the book or any of the preface of it before we actually get into these first judges? I guess I've got a little bit more here. Does anyone remember the god of Baal? What did Baal look like? What did they cast, or I guess how is it made typically? And I think Baal probably could look like multiple things, but does anybody remember what Baal looked like?
Wasn't Baal the generic name of many gods?
It was, yeah. So I think you had multiple. So that's why I say it's kind of tricky, but typically it was a bull. So when you think of it, and I think to Mike's point, Baal was just the general term, but when you do a lot of reading about it, typically they would cast that to look like a bull. And that was kind of known as their fertility god. And so I guess a lot of them considered that the god of agriculture as well. And if you read a lot about that, times of famine, when there was a lot of bad times, they would be mad at Baal because we're not getting enough rain. So I guess in our last 2 months, we've been mad at Baal. That would have been what they would have had. Okay. All right. And then, of course, the children of Israel done evil on the side of God, and they forgot him. And when they forgot him, they started serving Baals and Asheroths. We've mentioned that. When we hear the name Cushan Rishathaim, and I'm not sure I'm saying that right, does anybody remember what that meant literally? Because we read of that, but if you do a little research, it talks about Cushan of double wickedness. So again, this name here of double wickedness, we see where, and if we get into this, and these are just some things getting to Othniel, but we see where Othniel was the deliverer here. He was the servant to Cushan-Rishathaim. We read in the 13th verse of chapter 1, let me go back here. It says, "And Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it, so he gave him his daughter Aksa as a wife." And so the question was going to be, does anyone remember why Joshua had agreed to lead this attack? And Othniel was responding to an offer that Caleb, his uncle, had made, and to offer his daughter to whoever would lead this attack. Okay, so we have that. This first judge, does anybody remember some of the major things were talked about that were mentioned about Othniel? There's not a lot, but how many years of rest did they have after this judge? Or peace, I guess you'd say.
40.
Okay, 40. And we're going to see the cyclical number of 40 and 80 used a lot in Judges. Here we see 40. I don't know if we want to read this whole part, but it's a good story. I guess I say it's a good story. It's an interesting story. Will someone, let's do this. Will someone read in chapter 3, verses 12 through 30? You know what? I've got the mic. Let me just do that. So if you'll turn to Judges chapter 3, 12 through 30, we'll read this. I think this the judge of Ehud is a good story to read. And the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. Then he gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek, went and defeated Israel, and took possession of the city of the palms. So the children of Israel served Eglon, king of Moab, 18 years. And when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer from them, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. By him the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Ehud made himself a dagger. It was double-edged and a cubit in length, and fastened it under his clothes on his right thigh. So he brought the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now Eglon was a very fat man. And when he had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. But he himself turned back from the stone images and were at Gilgal and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. He said, keep silence. And all who attended him went out from him. And Ehud came to him. Now he was sitting upstairs in his cool private chamber. Then Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. So he rose from his seat. Then Ehud reached with his left hand, took the dagger from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. Even the hilt went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the dagger out of his belly, and his entrails came out. Then Ehud went out through the porch and shut the doors of the upper room behind him and locked them. Then he had gone out. Eglon's servants came to look, and to their surprise, the doors of the upper room were locked. So they said, he is probably attending to his needs in the cool chamber. So they waited till they were embarrassed and still had not opened the doors of the upper room. Therefore, they took the key and opened them, and there was their master fallen dead on the floor. But Ehud escaped while they delayed and passed under the stone images and escaped to Sira. It had happened when he arrived that he blew the trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel went down with him from the mountains, and they led him, and he led them. Then he said to them, follow me, the Lord has delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. So they went down after him, seized the fords of Jordan leading to Moab, and he did not allow anyone to cross over. And at that time they killed about 10,000 men of Moab, all stout men of valor, not a man escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rested for 80 years. So again, we have that 40 and 80 we talked about. So, pretty interesting story, some very specific details. You know, I was thinking about, we have a lot of descriptions in the Bible. Certain men are described maybe as being easy on the eyes, or people are described as easy on the eyes, or attractive, or a man of valor, this, that, but we don't really read very many times of a person that's that described as a very fat man. So that's kind of interesting. We also see that, and I think this is interesting, and I don't want to read too much into this, but I was reading and trying to gather some history outside of looking at the Bible. In those days, being left-handed was really considered a handicap, and I don't know that I knew that. But if you were left-handed, you were kind of considered as having a handicap. But it's interesting to think about that, because we know that God used Ehud. Who else do we read about that was left-handed? Or what type of people? You guys remember?
Later on in Judges, there's like 20,
chapter 20.
7,000 left-handed Benjamites.
Benjamites, yeah. And what do we know about the Benjamites? What were they skilled at? Okay, yeah. Slingers, I guess, yeah. So, but they were very skilled at what they did with their... I got slingers in my brain. Yeah. So, but I think the point here is that... And I don't know. Again, I'm just reading what history tells me. But if that was true, that they were considered a handicap, you know, I think it's interesting. We know that God uses, and we see this today, but various people with various talents, just how you are. And if they truly were considered handicapped, we see here that, you know, Ehud was used and he went in and killed the king. We know what the Benjamites did, and of course they, you know, I always thought that story was interesting, that this group of people, these Benjamites, would be skilled and they had worked on it. Makes you wonder, you know, is that to prove a point that they could be awesome at what they did, killing machines as slingers, as Tad's put it. So I don't know, but a lesson for us. I think, you know, there's some moments for us to pause and think about. You might think, well, I'm not the most skilled, or I can't do that, or you want me to, you know, how am I supposed to go talk to a brother or sister? Well, the Lord can use us all. We all have various talents, and those can all be used in today's work for the Lord. Okay.
Like, yeah. This is the first of many that we look in the Judges where God uses something that the world would say, really, you're gonna defeat your foes with that.
Right.
You know, here it's the left hand.
Yeah.
Later it's a tent peg.
Yeah.
A jawbone.
Yeah. Weird stuff.
We consistently see women involved too, which has the same connotation at that time as with the left hand.
Yeah.
You know, so this idea of these things that are perceived as weak,
yeah,
what God chose,
yeah,
to defend his people.
Yeah. Very good point. We're gonna make that throughout this, that God chose some very like you say, weak or obscure ways to show that, you know what, he's in control. And we read later of stories where they had too many men. Have you ever heard of having too many men to go to battle? Of course, there was a time with Joshua, they thought they were on a roll, remember? When they went up against Ai, oh, we don't need that many men, we're good. Well, there was a problem at that time. God wasn't on their side, and it wouldn't have mattered how many men they went with, they were defeated. Good point. Okay, if we skip ahead then, of course I read most of that chapter, verse 31, after him was Shamgar the son of Anath, who killed 600 men of the Philistines with an ox goad, and he also delivered Israel. Okay, so, you know, we've got a judge here killing 600 Philistines, and is he mentioned anywhere else in the Bible? Yeah, just in chapter 5, verse 6, but that's about it, just as a reference. So that is all we have of Shamgar.
It would look like Shamgar and Ehud together ruled during this 80 years, because after Ehud was dead, they did evil again.
Yeah.
Now, did they rule at the same time? Or did they rule in succession?
Well, and that's a good question. I had down here, I think that the point that we see here is that I don't think that how we read this is chronologically in order, because we see where the next chapter begins with the death of Ehud, which was the previous judge. So it might tell us that it's not in chronological order, or simultaneously.
But Deborah and Barak ruled at the same time.
Yeah.
Were judges at the same time.
Yeah,
the
yeah, they were.
Did these people stop being judges when they died, or did they stop being judges at a certain age, and then somebody else took over? I mean, if that was the case, then 31 in verse 1 would make sense that Ehud stopped being a judge at, you know, this age, and then Shamgar took over while Ehud was still alive, and then he died.
Yeah, I got the feeling, and somebody correct me, but it seemed like they judged up to the point of death. Now, that may not happen every single time, but it sure did seem like they would mention that they judged for this period of time, and then the rate of the death. So, I kind of got the feeling they judged right, or they were a judge right up to the point of death. But if anybody has another,
they definitely had influence
up to the point of the death.
The point,
sure,
because they were known as the champion of the nation. You know.
Yep. Yeah, I kind of got the feeling they did. Larry?
This is a sermon. How do you kill a person with an ox?
Well, you don't. That's the point. God has his hand in it. Yeah.
Because, I mean, an ox goad is something they jacked him with.
Yeah, but it's like a spear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. To your point, how do you do one person, one ox goad? Yeah. Yeah. A miracle. But, yeah, you know, you read these stories and you realize that.
Same way you kill him with a jawbone.
That's right. Yeah, we're getting ready to get to that point. I don't know.
Like David, you know, killed God, you know,
and
slain.
Yeah.
I mean, God takes the end of time spent.
Yeah, but the point is that God being for... But, you know, and let's pause for a second. We know, and these are Old Testament stories, but what does that tell us about God being for us today? He tells us, by being for you, no one's going to stand against you. But we kind of take that lightly for whatever reason sometimes. We read these stories, we have perfect evidence that when God was on their side...
Well, it's in His hands. I still think that He wants us to be very smart in our approach to how we handle things.
Sure.
With Ehud, yes, the Lord was with him, but I get the feeling that Ehud kind of planned this thing out, and he was smart and calculated about his actions whenever he went up against the king. This wasn't just a whim. So I think
He wants us to apply ourselves.
In our life, God wants us to be challenged and come up with good solutions and creative ways to maintain our faith in a wicked generation.
Oh, sure. Yep. We saw it then. Yeah, I don't think for one second that he just said, you know, I've got you taken care of. You can just stumble through this. They had to apply themselves, and we do too. So he's going to be on our side. We have to look to him and keep him at the center of our lives.
In fact, too often today we say, oh, I'm the left-hander.
Oh, yeah.
I just can't do this.
We do. Yeah.
And he accomplished great things by left-hand.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I think it's a great point for us. So I say there's some nuggets within all these stories that we say, well, those are Old Testament stories, and boy, they're crazy stories. But if we'll pause and just listen to what they're saying, I think there's some great lessons for us here. So here in chapter 4 begins kind of the third period or the cycle of the judges. Verse 1 is a definite red flag. When Ehud was dead, the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord. Ugh. Makes you go, what are you doing? You know, just turned to him. Things seemed to be on a roll. But we see this red flag statement happen over and over and over. And that is, they did evil in the sight of the Lord. And when they did evil in the sight of the Lord, we see the Lord turn from them. They turn from him, and he just allows things to happen. So we see in the second verse that the Lord allowed the Israelites to be sold into the hands of their oppressors, specifically Jabin, who is the king of Canaan. And we're told that the commander of his army was Sisera, which gets us into the next story. Verse 3 lets us know that he had 900 chariots that he had cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years. And then they finally cried to the Lord for help. You know, I think this is another moment for us to pause. So it took them 20 years before they would cry out to the Lord. You know, you think, well, man, that seems like a long time. Of course, I guess, you know, we're an outsider looking in at this. But, you know, I find it odd that they waited that long before they would turn to God. You know, it kind of reminds me, you know, if you think to the prodigal son, you know, I don't think it took him too long before he's eating with the pigs to realize, this isn't really working out. This isn't good. I think I've messed up. But here we see these children, and they were just stubborn. That once they'd make a wrong move, they would do this for a long time. And I think this is a perfect example for us. And I hope that none of us would go 20 years of being stubborn or turning our back on God. But I think the point here is that the second we see we have strayed or turned from Him or made a mistake, that's an immediate cause for us to turn back. An immediate opportunity for us to take advantage of asking for forgiveness and changing. And we see them just, they made these poor decisions, and it took them forever. But I think the interesting part is that the second they asked for help, what would happen? Basically, God would turn to them. In chapter 4, verses 4 through 13, we just won't read all that for sake of time, but we learn some details here about Deborah. We learn of the term prophetess, or that term is used. We know that that's used other places in the Bible, but Deborah was a prophetess. We see here that she was the wife of Lapidoth, which is an important, you know, fact. Verse 4, and I'll just read that. Now, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. So here she was already judging Israel at this time. We know from her military victory that we're getting ready to look at. You can see here in verse 5, it says, "And she would sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel and the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel came up to her for her judgment. Okay, you know, we can read in the book of Judges about certain judges, and you don't hardly see that word being used, that they were actually judging. So we see that she was doing, not only she was a true judge, but there were other things going on there, but she was an authority. We see here in verse 6, then she sent and called for Barak, the son of Abinoam, from Kadesh in Naphtali, and she said to him, "Has not the Lord God of Israel commanded, saying, go and deploy troops at Mount Tabor? Take with you 10,000 men of the sons of Naphtali and of the sons of Zebulun." Well, what would be a little bit odd for this? Who is she? What's she doing? Well, she's in charge. And to Ben's point, that's not something that we typically saw of women at that time. Okay? So she was a prophetess. She was passing judgment. And now she's basically speaking to Barak. So how does Barak respond to this? If you've read this before, you remember, what's Barak basically say, in paraphrase?
"I'm not going without you."
Okay. Which, what else does that tell us about him? I don't really know. I've read that a few times. I'm not sure exactly. Maybe he had a character flaw. Maybe he needed her support. Maybe he knew, I don't know, maybe his faith was weak. But later, what do we know about Barak? Was his faith weak? Well, I don't want to give it away yet, but let's just ask this. In Hebrews chapter 11, who's mentioned there? Was it Deborah or Barak? Barak. It's Barak. Well,
in verse 9, it's kind of funny. She says it.
Yeah.
What she says about him not getting the glory. But then, like you said in Hebrews, he was the one mentioned.
So we know there's some details here we don't know. We don't fully understand. But we know that Barak was mentioned in those that had great faith. So he obviously did. But I wanted to pause here because I find that it's an interesting little exchange. And I don't want to read into it too much. But again, we know that he was mentioned at that time. But Deborah being very important here. So we see Deborah, yeah, fulfilling her role. Yeah.
To see this point, the thing that Deborah says to Barak isn't that Barak's not going to be well known for what happens. He didn't get the glory. And it's interesting, he says, you know, sell it. The Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. She's not talking about herself. She's talking about another woman. We'll talk about it in a minute.
Yeah.
And the glory is that Barak didn't get to kill Sisera.
Yeah.
You remember some of the previous stories we talked about where the five kings are shut sure. in the cave. What
yeah.
happened? Joshua gets to be the one to kill him.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, that's
some glory in that. Yeah.
I think that's where the glory comes in.
Okay. Good point. I wanted to. Do we cut off at 10 after or 15? About now. Okay, I'm going to ring the bell. I had some reading here I wanted to do. We might just recap. I wanted to look and see here because I was going to read verses 14 through 24. But we know later that Deborah did go with Barak, and they led their forces to a stunning victory. You know, when you think about it on paper, who should have won? Wasn't them, of course. And we see here in verse 20, and I'm in, let's see here. I want to make sure I'm in the right place. Oh, verse 20 of chapter 5, it says, they fought from the heavens, the stars from their courses fought against Sisera. I think this is interesting that we get the feeling here that, you know, what does that statement really mean? That the Lord was on their side, but...
Actually, it was the Lord that defeated it.
Yeah.
Said routed Sisera.
That's right.
And then, after that, Barak's faith and confidence really grew, and then he started running. He chased after him. He said he pursued.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good story, and we might pick up there where we left off, but, you know, every single soldier had died by the sword, and then he was killed by another woman, Jael. And Ben's kind of brought it up and alluded to it, but everybody remembers that story. He went in the tent and said, you know, hey, if anybody asks for me, tell them no man's in here. And Jael took the tent spike or peg and drove it right through his temple all the way into the ground. So we'll pick up in chapter 5. If you want to do some reading of Judges, it won't take you long to get through the end of the chapter, but we're definitely going to cover the rest of the Judges in Judges chapter 5, and we'll pick up there next week. Thanks for your comments.